Greetings and welcome to the worldwide leader in contrarian a-holery. Yes, it is. Objection. And Mr. Dan Mancini is here, and I am Mr. Dave Johnson. Mr. I feel like I'm in romper room. I probably don't. Right. We're here to, be the internet dillweeds that you crave so much.
Like there aren't enough of them.
There aren't enough. Yeah, there just aren't enough. But at least we have last names, Dan. Right?
That's got and we're professional. I mean, there's a lot of amateur dillweeds out there.
That's right. Pros. What are the credentials? Like, what kind of credentialing goes into that?
Into dillweedery?
Dillweedery.
I think a degree in the humanities helps.
Definitely. Yeah, some kind of liberal arts program that's recognized. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, we're here, and the outline of the show is we're going to take it upon ourselves to defend the indefensible, and we certainly have carved ourselves out a challenge this week, but we'll save that later.
This may top Waterworld.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think there's a question about it. I think it will be. It will be the most challenging of of our young pot objection career so far. But before we get into that, we have been trying to balance out the a-holery with just to prove that we don't, spend our entire life grumbling and mumbling, and that we're going to support some things that have some solid consensus backup. I mean, because we're not complete douches, right, Dan?
Not complete.
I mean, 80 to 85%, I guess, right, on the douche meter. So, but anyway, because we've got a new movie coming out by this director, we thought we'd be timely and kind of celebrate his two big films that have been widely recognized by both geeks and non-geeks. I think there's a nexus of geeks and non-geeks that come to appreciate these movies. And they're Edgar Wright's kick-ass double billing of Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, two of my favorite movies of all time.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's not hyperbole. Like, to me, Hot Fuzz, I mean, when I reviewed it on HD DVD, I gave it, hundreds across the board. And that's on HD DVD, so that's what it tells you. So, that is one of my favorite movies, probably in my top 10. And the Shaun of the Dead is nipping at its heels.
Yeah. I mean, both brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
You know, and the question, what makes them brilliant? Because a lot of people strive for that kind of genre movie parody. You know, Lord knows that I am subjected to countless attempts at it on a weekly basis with DVDs that show up at my doorstep. And they nearly all fail utterly. But these guys are two for two. So right. I've got a theory, but I wanted to see what you think. Why do you think they're successful in tackling both, like the zombie horror movie and the action?
Well, most parody movies are just parody movies, But the thing is, and I'm a fan of both zombie movies and cop buddy flicks. And the thing is, Shaun of the Dead, yeah, it's a parody, but it's a zombie movie too. And Hot Fuzz is a parody, but it is a cop buddy movie. Like, it understands the rhythms and everything so perfectly that Hot Fuzz functions as a cop flick and Shaun of the Dead functions as a horror movie.
And, that's pretty much what I was thinking, what I would agree with, because, like, Hot Fuzz in particular, I mean, they are spoofing conventions, They've got like the car chase where they're shooting out the windows and going high speed, but they add a goose, right? Or a duck. Right. They add a duck in the background, or like the whole Point Break thing,
Right.
They spoof that, but it's not like making fun of it. They love these movies. They love them, And they just kind of replicate them in their own bizarre way. So they just employ these cliches and genre conventions, add a genuinely interesting story and a good script, but they're not like being mean about it. You can tell that they love it. So it's more homage almost than a straight.
Right. Point. Right. And then on top of it, both movies have that kind of British wit in terms of the dialogue. That's just, like in Hot Fuzz, any scene that has the Andes in it, I'm just completely rolling on the floor because of the stuff that they say. And a lot of it's pretty subtle, it can just whip by you, but just the dialogue in those movies is brilliant.
But it's not a British comedy. I mean, because it's a very American action movie.
Oh,
the Michael Bay circle panning shots, the 360 pan shots, you know, the slow motion gun draws. So there's a lot of those American muscle bound conventions in there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But it's got that kind of British sly wit to it where, you know, American humor might be a little bit broader.
Yeah, that's
not that there's not broad humor.
Yeah, no, that's a good
point. But there is. But it always cracks me up when the Andes ask Nick Angel what other evidence he has. And he's like, skid marks. And one of the Andes is like, now who's being childish? And he's like, no, there were no skid marks at the scene of the crime. You know, that kind of thing where in an American-made movie, there would probably just be like a fart in there or something.
I think you're right. In fact, and another something going towards that as well. And I knew that this was the movie for me. And it came out right at the beginning when they were doing Nick's montage of just badassness.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And like when he does the bike skid with that look, tight zoom look, you know what I'm talking about? Again, very subtle, but it's like hilarious. And I said, I'm going to love this movie just because it's just fantastic. Just that little moment grabbed me immediately.
Absolutely.
And we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Mr. Timothy Dalton, who is legendary in this movie.
Oh, man, he's great. You can just tell he's having a blast.
Oh, yeah.
It's great.
Absolutely. And then it throws it, so you're kind of in the groove, and then sometimes you get this curveball where you have this incredible amount of crazy gore thrown at you. You know, like when the steeple impales the guy's head out of nowhere, and it's like genuinely shocking, but they get away with it just because they've kind of built this surreal setup as it is.
Yeah, and I mean, that's how Shaun of the Dead is, too. You get the gag where the one guy gets pulled through the window. It's sort of like the classic Tom Savini-style special effect where the zombies pull him in half and pull all of his entrails out and start eating him and stuff. Right. And you can't have a zombie movie without that.
Of course not.
They pull it off. It's not like, oh, you know, it's a comedy movie and they kind of, you know, there's a little bit of blood here and there. I mean, they really have great effects throughout.
Yeah, they indulge, definitely. Both those movies are rewarding on repeat viewings.
I've lost count of how many times.
Absolutely.
I've watched each.
And then a little trivia here. This is a little, maybe it's bragging. I don't know. Probably not. But I actually got a couple emails from the twins, like the Butcher twins in Hot Fuzz. They had emailed and just kind of said, hey, thanks for the heads up. And I just asked, and I was just, hey, thanks. You guys are awesome. So that was a great scene as well. The butcher shop, and they're just like, it's being shot like this Saving Private Ryan fusillade war, you know?
Yeah.
And these
yeah.
guys are just like throwing meats and things, you know?
I love when one of the Andes is like, don't worry, it's just bolognese when he has red.
Yes. Or when Nick kicks himself because he couldn't think of an awesome one-liner, you know, after laying out the giant guy. Totally. I think we're totally swimming in the right mainstream by praising these two movies. And it'll be interesting to see what. Because Scott Pilgrim looks like a radically different kind of movie.
Yeah. You know?
And it's based on an existing property, so.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Edgar Wright does without Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
You know, and I have seen what Simon Pegg has done without Edgar Wright, and he was in that Run, Fat Boy, Run. I'm not sure if he wrote it, but he was in it. That was not a good, I don't think that movie was very good, so.
Yeah, it was pretty mediocre.
Yeah, we'll see if they're like the Wonder Twins, you know, if they're apart from each other, they're not home run hitters. But together, I think they just crank out legendary movies, so.
Oh, man. Brilliant.
Brilliant. So, that's enough of that crap talking nice about. Defending, yeah, those are layups. Now we're going to really go for the split in bowling, I suppose. That might be it, or climbing Kilimanjaro. I'm trying to compare with this next topic is going to be, but we're going to tackle probably the most imposing subject we have on this podcast, and that is defending one Jar Jar Binks.
Yes.
Wow. Maybe we could clarify. Are we going to say he is a masterful, nuanced creation, a textbook example of character development? Probably not. But I think we're going to try to put forward the case that, A, he's not the devil, and B, he's not the reason that you think George Lucas treated your childhood like a urinal cake.
Right.
And I think if we can achieve that, that's still quite monumental.
If this were a court of law, just because somebody's a scumbag does not automatically make them guilty of the crimes.
That's right.
Which they're accused, so...
That's right. So now we typically kind of read snippets, you know, from reviews of movies that have been panned. But I don't really have that. I guess we could just kind of go anecdotal unless you have something.
I did. I actually went through and pulled up some Jar Jar specific quotes from a variety of
about one of us that's a
print magazine. So we've got Wired News. These are all from 99 when the movie first came out. Phantom Menace first came out. So Wired News said Lucas could have toned down the Jar Jar Binks character a tad, though, as he was often annoying. What's up with that Jamaican accent? The Village Voice said the film's designated alien is Jar Jar Binks, a rabbit-eared ambulatory lizard whose pidgin English degenerates from pseudo-Caribbean patois to Teletubby gurgle.
Ouch.
Time magazine chimed in with the new sidekick, a computer-birthed frog boy named Jar Jar Binks, is a vexing, endearing mix of Kipling's Gunga Din and Tolkien's Gollum.
There was an adjective in there that wasn't awful, right?
Yeah, yeah, and speaks in a pidgin English.
Oh, pidgin English again.
Yeah, entertainment. Yeah, this is sort of the theme, and this is what cracks me up. It really reveals critics as like the echo chamber gang, where they just repeat each other and repeat each other, and nobody has an original thought. Entertainment Weekly was the Phantom Menace throws in a rabbit-eared mascot named Jar Jar Binks, whose goofy tongue-twisting patois. Again,
patois. Oh, wow, and rabbit-eared.
How often do you hear the word patois used in a review? But once one critic does it, then everybody has to jump in. That renders him a nuisance within 30 seconds, that patois. And then the last one I pulled was Newsweek, and that's for comic relief we get the computer-generated Jar Jar Binks, a goofy, floppy-eared, vest-wearing toy serpent with a clumsy two-legged lope and an incomprehensible Caribbean accent. He's a kind of extraterrestrial step-and-fetch-it.
Man, they're really picking on the lope, huh? I guarantee you they didn't write that in their review for I Am Sam. I guarantee.
No.
All right. So, and then I'm sure we can reel off countless anecdotes, and circumstantial evidence that we've heard over the years. I think it's fair game to say that fanboys across Star Wars spectrum have little use for Jar Jar Binks. So that is the consensus. So now it moves to us.
Okay, it's your move.
And yes, thank you, Mr. Glover. Again, it is indeed our move. And to help us face this incredible challenge, we're going to bring in a heavy hitter, a big gun, someone who I consider one of the shining lights of contrarian aholery, and that is Mr. David Ryan. Dave, welcome aboard.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
We are fantastic.
I got to say, being in the objection green room for the last 10-odd minutes, it's a very lovely setup you have in there. The crystal was excellent.
Oh, good, good.
And the waitresses could not have been more pleasant.
See, thank me. Dan had wanted to put Yoo-Hoo in there.
Now, I do have to ask, did our interns remove all of the green M&Ms as you requested?
I'm afraid they didn't, and I may have been a little coarse with one of them.
They deserve it.
I don't want to use the phrase weeping in the corner hideously, but, they're weeping in the corner. Quite hideously.
That you must have been really bad because they're, as you can imagine, they're used to a-holery. So
they are. Oh yeah, that green room has seen its share, my friend.
Yeah. But one of them said you got them cheap from Cambodian labor camps. Apparently, they're not good enough for the slave labor of the Khmer Rouge, and therefore their only choice is to turn to you for employment.
Well, that was quite an eBay bidding war for sure. But
yeah, so
we came out on top. Well,
I'm very happy to be here and
good
for inviting me.
All right. Well, Dave, we're going to just put the ball right in your court. I mean, you kind of heard Dan so eloquently pull together some choice quotes lambasting Jar Jar Binks. So we'll let you kind of get the first shot off. Why do you think he is not as awful as pop culture has deemed him to be?
If you put Die Jar Jar Die into Google, I think you get over like 100,000 hits. So there's a general feeling out there that Jar Jar is a waste of time. But there's a bigger issue with the Star Wars films in general. And that is, I don't think people fully understand what Lucas was specifically trying to do. And the best way to figure it out is to go back and watch Mystery Science Theater, as a matter of fact. And you may remember they had some shorts from the late 30s, early 40s, Flash Gordon ripoffs that were just hokey, serialized stories. And this whole film series is really George Lucas's homage to those Flash Gordon-style serials. And people don't seem to remember that those things were idiotic. And they were really poorly made. And so what Lucas is doing is making a better version of a really poor source material. it's kind of like Boogie Nights in that way. And this is probably the only time you'll ever hear Jar Jar Binks and Boogie Nights in the same sentence without really wanting to gouge your eyes out and pretend you had never heard anything.
Yeah, that sounds like some kind of freaky cosplay, you know.
Or a really bad slash fic. One of the two.
And to clarify, Dave, you're kind of looking at the entire franchise, all six movies, not just the prequels, right?
Exactly. The stuff with the Trade Federation and, oh boy, we have this exciting, you know, action adventure about trade policy and the fringes of the galaxy. Well, a lot of just really ham-fisted setup was present in those Flash Gordon things as well. And when you look at the whole picture, you get a better idea what Lucas was going for. And in that context, if you remember all the Westerns, like Gunsmoke and all that, there was always the goofy cook who had the stupidest lines in the film or the show. And he was there to just lighten the mood and detract or at least turn your attention away from the drama or the tension going on, you know, lighten the mood. And Jar Jar fills that role in Star Wars. There's another thing you got to remember, too, and that is these are kids' films. And when you have kids' films, you got to have characters that will appeal to kids. And very often, those characters are not going to appeal to adults at all. So my core thesis here, and I do have a PhD in Jar Jarology from the University of London. So the core thesis is that Jar Jar is misinterpreted by adults who assume that he is an adult character in an adult film, which is absolutely not the case and was never intended to be the case. And you can dislike Jar Jar as a character because he's childish and silly and you don't find him funny, but it's wrong to hate him as some kind of abomination of nature just because your expectations were wrong. And that's my ultimate feeling about Jar Jar. And I feel bad for Jar Jar. And I actually think, and we'll go over this you know, together here, there's some aspects of Jar Jar that aren't so bad. And if you view the films the way they should be viewed, yeah, he's not Laurence Olivier doing Hamlet with Sir John Gielgud or anything like that, but it's an adequate character for the role that it's intended to play.
All right. Dan, what do you say?
That covers it nicely. No, I agree. And having a young child myself and being able to see the movie through his eyes, it is for kids, particularly The Phantom Menace. That is really a kid's movie. And they do love Jar Jar. And they do love Anakin and all of the characters. In, you know, kids kind of that, let's say, 5 to 10 years old now, tend to like the prequels better than the original movies, which is, you know, probably horrifying to 30-something nerds, but that's the way it is. It's their generation. That's what they've kind of grown up with. And I wouldn't take him over Chewbacca, but
I would see 3PO.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing. Because of the fanboy violent reaction to Jar Jar, and then the character essentially being stripped out of the next two movies, it's like Lucas forced C-3PO then into that role. And so, to me, it undermined C-3PO's character because he's not consistent with who he is in the original trilogy. He's more buffoonish. I mean, he was sort of more imperious, and he was always annoying and always comic relief, but he was kind of a character who thought too highly of himself. I personally don't find him that annoying. He's not in the movie enough, but I think Dave's right that you have 30-somethings who wanted the movie to be geared toward them when the original films weren't geared towards 30-somethings when they came out. And so they wanted, you know, really serious space battles from beginning to end. They didn't want, you know, Jar Jar accidentally killing a droid. Like, that ruins the movie. It's like the Trade Federation that he brought up, you know, the trade routes in dispute and how people were annoyed by that and stuff. And it's like the only people who would be annoyed by that, so far as I can tell, are people who read all the Star Wars novels and, like, want to be able to fill in every blank. Because to me, I didn't even notice it. Who cares? It's a throwaway thing. It's an excuse to get into the lightsaber battles. I don't really care what the trade dispute is. It's just set up. But it's like people were offended because, well, that's just ridiculous that this whole thing is based around a trade dispute. Well, who cares? There's Jedi fighting with lightsabers.
And you know, that brings up a point, too, going to something else. I remember hearing Lucas saying that he's always thought the Star Wars movies work best, like, silent movies, like you can just watch them. I mean, maybe that's a cop-out saying, yeah, my dialogue's wooden or whatever, but he had said, like, you know, I've always kind of designed these movies quite need a reliance on plot development and dialogue, or whatever. But, you know, building off of both you guys said, I think the perspective is a big deal. But Jar Jar on the list of things that don't float my boat about that movie is pretty far down, actually. I think the guy has just been turned into a scapegoat. As far as annoying characters, you know, Jake Lloyd annoyed me, you know, more than that. You know,
yes, thank you. But, yeah. You know, you can't criticize the kid.
Of course not. I mean, Qui-Gon annoyed me because he was kind of a dope, you know, but he's Liam Neeson. So what are you going to say?
Well, I mean, I think the movies, in all three movies, biggest flaw, it's not really a problem of dialogue. People obsess over that. The dialogue's not great. It's functional dialogue. What do you want? It's a space opera.
And it's functional, like in the same in the original trilogy. I mean, there's some memorable lines, but a lot of those were ad-libbed.
The real problem with the trilogy is a problem of direction. Lucas's directing of actors. The fact that he walked into this not realizing what sacred ground Star Wars had been. The original actors in the first trilogy, they didn't treat this like it was Shakespeare because it was some pop culture phenomenon. You know, they had dialogue in front of them. If they didn't like it, they made it work. They changed it. They did whatever they needed to do. Lucas has never been known as a great director of actors. I get the sense that with a few exceptions, Ewan McGregor, Ian McDiarmid, a few other people, the actors in the prequel trilogy treated the text like it was Shakespeare because it's Star Wars. You know, they didn't say, well, this, you know, reading it this way doesn't really work for me. Let me try it a different way, which by all accounts, that's exactly what Harrison Ford did throughout the first trilogy. And the fact that he's the director and he didn't get his actors to a place where they were delivering the dialogue in a way that really works. But it's not the dialogue's fault. It's functional dialogue. You know, it's not David Mamet.
And you know, the actors, they had blue screens to work, green screens to work against. They were responding to things that didn't actually exist. And I know there was a lot of complaints, or I wouldn't say complaints, because you know, you don't want to upset the gravy train if you're one of the actors, but frustration with how they were able to act given those technological constraints. I actually think we're ranging off topic here. I apologize, but I think this is actually a great Ewan McGregor acting job, because when you think about it, he could not create a character in Obi-Wan. He had to play it however Alec Guinness had chosen to play it in the original Star Wars, because if the progression from the Obi-Wan he played in Episode 1 to the Episode 4 Obi-Wan was not seamless and believable, boy, you think the hatred against Jar Jar is bad. That would have been, forget it.
Yeah.
If he had played him like, you know, David Tennant's Doctor Who, and then all of a sudden he ages a little and he turns into Alec Guinness, that wouldn't have flown. So to have to work within somebody else's decisions about your character, complete decisions about your character, is a pretty tough challenge. And I think he did a very good job with it.
And the other thing is, unfair to him, and this kind of goes the direction, maybe a little bit to the script, but especially in The Phantom Menace, Obi-Wan had nothing to do. He was really doing nothing. He was kept on the sidelines forever until his shining, highly choreographed lightsaber fight at the end, which, you know, the fanboys jump on and love and worship and stuff. But really, I mean, he's sitting on the starship. He's not really doing much. And I guess that just kind of goes towards he's got a blue screen. He's got an iconic character he's got to work towards. He's got two more movies in the future as well that this character is going to go in, and he's got to kind of cultivate that. And all along, he's kind of a second banana to Qui-Gon, and he's just kind of kept off the sidelines.
And I'll say this, the least favorite of the prequel trilogy for me is Attack of the Clones. But man, the Obi-Wan half of that movie works perfectly for me. Mm-hmm. I have zero problem with, you know, his whole investigation. All of those scenes that Ewan McGregor is in, he sells them. As far as
I would agree, yeah. It's the rolling around in the hay with the two young lovers that makes you want to flee the theater.
It's the discussions about sand in your nether regions. It's, you're exactly right.
And that, even that, if you took the Naboo part out of it and you just kept those two characters moving, if Lucas had just paid attention to what happened with Empire Strikes Back and kept those two characters moving in action, then I think when that is going on, then Hayden Christensen and Natalie Portman are fine. It's when the characters sort of slow down, they start having problems, and I think a big part of it is they're just not getting direction, I suspect, from Lucas, anything helpful. And Hayden Christensen is pretty much acting against a dead fish, it seemed like to me, you know, in those scenes. He's just like, give me something here that I can work off of. She's like a mannequin.
Yes.
He's not a terrible actor. I mean, he's proven that he can work in Life is a House.
Shattered Glass.
And of course, Natalie Portman, I think, you know, is potential Academy Award material at some point. But the two of them together, I've seen first grade plays with better acting than that. I just don't understand what happened there in that film. It was it was just inexplicable. But you're right. The only parts work fine.
Yeah, and I get the sense she just kind of checked out after Phantom Menace, after the poor reviews and stuff. She was just sort of like, I'm filling a space here, but I'm not totally engaged in what.
And I think it got noticeably worse in Revenge of the Sith as well, when she's arguably got the most emotional stuff to deal with. It's kind of the least involving. But just to pull it back to Jar Jar, as we're talking about the other two movies, his role significantly decreases. You think that was Lucas responding to fanboy outcry?
I think that's precisely what it was.
Okay.
Because he still left Jar Jar in as the pivotal character in the history of this entire war. And I have a feeling that Jar Jar probably would have had a more prominent role in these films, but for the response to Phantom Menace. On the other hand, I can also see an argument that he would have had a more important role, but what he did get was essentially thrown in the trash by making him more serious, because they turn him into a senator. You know, that's hardly a position for comic relief, unless you're filming Benson. But it just sort of marginalized him, because now he's fulfilling a role that we've moved on from. You know, we've moved on from the Galactic Senate for the most part in Clones.
Yeah.
And, you know, except to the extent that we see Palpatine consolidating his power. And Jar Jar just gets, you know, caught in the backwash. And then is he even in the third film? I don't even know.
A tiny bit. And see, I think it's a missed opportunity, too, because you have, you know, in the first film, Jar Jar and Anakin are, you know, they're building this friendship. And so there was a potential there for, you know, imagine in the original trilogy, if, you know, Han Solo goes evil, where does that leave Chewbacca? You know, what happens to him? There's a potential for some poignancy there that got chucked out the window by the second film because of fan reaction.
Now, let me ask you this. If we took it out of a vacuum and the same fanboys who piled on Jar Jar, and again, just were to look with the same critical eye without the nostalgia and all that, and I brought this up earlier, but at C-3PO, who always seemed to occupy that Jar Jar role in the original trilogy for me, do you think it's fair to compare them? Do you think, because I've always thought C-3PO was kind of useless, you know, kind of there for comic relief.
Yeah, at least Jar Jar does something. You know, 3PO just kind of like fails to move his arm and complains.
But why does he get a pass, you know?
Yeah, and gets himself shot in Empire.
And he rips on R2 for getting blasted at the Endor, you know, the Endor fight scene. And, you know, R2's just detonating or whatever. He's, some of the best stuff in Empire was Han Solo just sticking it to C-3PO, you know? Yeah, but that was Han Solo being awesome and C-3PO annoying. So
yeah, I mean, he's C-3PO in the original is sort of like this anachronism where, you know, he doesn't fit into this world anymore. Like what the world of the original trilogy? What use do they have for a protocol droid? For God's sake, it's like the Wild Frontier. Who needs that? You know, translation services okay a little bit, but other than that, what use is he? Which has a sort of sadness to it, but.
When push comes to shove, what use really was he in reality in the first film is it was George Lucas being smart and referencing The Hidden Fortress with the same two characters. And but except they're robots because we're in outer space now. You know, it's this inside movie joke. And once again, you wind up with fanboy, you know, people who were 6-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds when these films came out. They don't care. You know, they don't get that. They're not, you know, sitting in film school in San Francisco at the time these films are being released. And they view 3PO and R2 as something completely different. And the entire point is lost that they were almost in jokes to begin with.
And you look, you look even at Luke Skywalker, and I think this shows a sort of cultural difference between now and the 70s. The 70s when there was no internet I guess people in their 30s didn't waste their time.
And there was no Star Wars. Star Wars yet.
And messing around with, you know, talking about movies that in this depth. But, you know, adults in 1977 did kind of say, Luke Skywalker's kind of whiny. And probably if that trilogy came out today, you would have fanboys just bitching about it to no end. You know, if they'd come out in order, we got episodes 4 through 6 second, then, you know, there would probably be endless complaining about how could that possibly be Darth Vader's son? He's such a candy ass, and all he does is complain about everything and whine. And
I think if Star Wars came out today in the absence of everything else, it'd be like Spy Kids. It would make a good deal of money. Maybe there'd be a couple of straight-to-video sequels, but it was the combination of really having nothing like it prior to that, just the visual impact of it, plus the age of the people who were its primary audience combined to form this perfect storm, mythologizing Star Wars, right, which has tainted everything else in the series. You know, taken as just a straight sci-fi action series, the 6-film sequence is pretty darn good. I mean, even the bad films, quote-unquote, are pretty good. Frankly, better than a lot of what is put out in Hollywood. You know, look at Transformers. You think, you know, the Phantom Menace's story is bad.
Right.
Transformers Rise of the Fallen is, you know, the story is just the loosest, flimsiest excuse to hang explosions on that you've ever seen in your life. So, you know, there are far worse things out there. And that's basically what my point is with Jar Jar, is there are far worse characters even in the Star Wars trilogy. Double trilogy? I don't even know how to refer to it anymore. Yeah. just the levels of hatred for Jar Jar, I just find inexplicable. And I think it's unfair to Ahmed Best, the actor who voiced him and who did the motion capture for Jar Jar's mannerisms and actions, because we haven't seen him. I mean, I'm sure this poor guy, and I confess, I was in the audience for a Late Late Show with Craig Kilborn, where he was the guest. And he seemed like a very nice guy. And I'm sure he thought that this was his ticket to stardom and success.
Yeah.
And he has disappeared. I think he does a good deal of voice work, but certainly not the level of celebrity he anticipated, I'm sure. And it's almost not fair because I think he does a very good job with the character. I think it's very difficult to do voice acting, especially when your voice acted character is up against live action humans. You know, it's one thing to do an animated film where everybody is doing voice acting, but when you really have no control over your character's facial expressions and the animators are almost relying on your vocal performance to guide them in the animation, and you're going to be up against Ewan McGregor and Liam Neeson, that's a daunting task, and I think he did a pretty good job. I think Jar Jar is a sympathetic character if you strip away the hatred.
And that is a first, too. I mean, the Phantom Menace kind of pioneered that motion capture.
Yeah.
I mean, Jar Jar was the first type of that character to be seamlessly integrated into live action, I think. So.
And I'll be so bold as to say, too, that as a piece of animation, I think he absolutely blows Gollum away.
Wow, that is bold.
From Lord. I mean, Gollum is a more interesting character, more subtle character, and that comes from Tolkien. But when you look at him as a piece of animation, he's certainly no more impressive than Jar Jar Binks. And I think in a lot of ways, in terms of some of the compositing and stuff, he's much less impressive. Particularly, there's a lot less texture to him, obviously, since he's only wearing a loincloth and stuff. Some of the, having recently watched that trilogy again on Blu-ray, you know, some of those effects are not where he's interacting with the real world. They're not as impressive as they were. I mean, Jar Jar is a pretty impressive piece of animation.
And I think, like, to me, I may not go as far as that, but I think I would say that you can't say that Gollum, you know, doesn't owe anything to Jar Jar, or that technology right. doesn't owe anything to Jar Jar. You know what I mean? So, I mean, it's purely from a technical standpoint, you have to admit that, I mean, this is 97. I mean, even before, early. I mean, what, 95, 96 probably, if you're talking about, you know, before it was released. Is that right? When did Phantom Menace come out?
99.
Thank you. Okay. 99. So, but that technology was still so early. So it kind of built, I don't know, I think it'd be a crime not to track that lineage, you know?
Yeah, just look at the animation done for Jabba the Hutt in the re-release of Episode 4, and that was only, what, 3 years prior to Phantom Menace? And it's like night and day.
Oh, it is. I mean, absolutely.
Jabba looks like a bad video game character now. Jar Jar still holds up when you view that film. I mean, I have to agree, he was a well-done piece of computer animation. So,
well, how about this, guys? As we wrap this up, let's just share our Jar Jar moments that we did not despise. How about that? Dan, why don't you go first?
Let's see. Well, I think some of the scenes in the ship where he's talking to Padme are pretty good. You know, they're pretty subtle, not over the top, crazy, hilarious, and I think they work. I mean, I think there's real emotion in some of that.
How about you, Dave?
My favorite, Jarl, I like the tongue thing with the pod racers, but just because it's good, you know, Buster Keaton slapstick and Best plays it fairly subtly, which I think works in that particular case. It's not a Jim Carrey performance. It's a little more restrained and calm. But I really like when Qui-Gon is talking to him about why he was booted from the Gungan city. It's because he's clumsy. And you feel kind of, you know, there's more to the story, but you feel kind of bad for the poor creature. You know, he's just a little happy klutz, and his people didn't like him. And, you know, I tend to get a little something in my eye.
Nice. Wow,
very nice.
Wow, so your blood is not ice cold. Is that what you're saying? Zima doesn't flow through your veins, does it? Okay.
I can use a nice Zima right now.
I think for me, I actually like the intro to his character, where, like, the first time you see him, he's, like, standing in the middle of the forest completely confused, right, while the droid army just kind of destroys everything. And then he's running away, and I think Qui-Gon grabs him, right? They bring him to the pond, and then it could be kind of mean, but Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon it's like they don't even look him in the eye, or they don't really like him that much. You know, like, what do you have here, a local or something like that?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's like they're baffled by him, and they live in a universe where there's all kinds of weird aliens. And
yeah,
stuff.
So I think, like, I mean, that kind of endeared him to me. I mean, he's kind of this goofy, confused guy, and then these two Jedi really don't really think he's kind of kind of an idiot. So I found him endearing.
They treat him like an abandoned puppy who can talk.
That's right. That is what they do. It's like expect him to show up on one of those Suzanne's.
Oh, great. Now I got to feed and clean up after this thing. Oh, terrific.
And that's really what he is. I mean, Chewbacca was the dog character in the originals, and Jar Jar is in the prequels. You know, he's the sort of puppy.
And the funny thing is that, to an extent, Obi-Wan is the puppy, too.
True. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, he's just there so that Qui-Gon has somebody to talk to.
He's the neglected puppy in the corner, you know, just...
Because internal monologues don't play well on screen.
Well, I think that was a valiant effort. That's our longest objection podcast ever, Dan, and I think we laid out a pretty good case for Jar Jar. Well, we'll see how this plays. But give him a second look, people. He is not the source of woe in your life. I think that's what we can agree on.
Yeah.
So cut the guy some slack. So...
He did not ruin your childhood.
He did not ruin your childhood. Jar Jar did not.
Free Jar Jar. Free Jar Jar.
So, Dave, thank you for joining us and taking up this noble pursuit.
You are very welcome.
And I'm sure we will see you again shortly with our next challenge, which it'll be tough to outdo this one, but I think we come up with something. So, yeah, with that, Dan, I guess we're done for this episode of Objection.
Good evening.
Thanks. 10 points easy. Ha 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 ha